again, just before I decide to do this. You know, I got my degree in geology back in New England, from Maine, and then I went and got a master's degree in volcanology, which is exceptionally unemployable, and got that degree and then realized that maybe that was not ideal, but it was interesting. And I ended up in consulting, and I went into initially environmental consulting work, and got involved with sort of engineering geology types of activities, and I've been doing that for the last 15 years or so. I work for a company called Jacobs Associates, and we do tunnels.
And you do what?
Tunnels, underground structures, so caverns and pipelines and water lines and roadways and all kinds of crazy things. So I work with a bunch of, mostly engineers, a lot of them were geologists and they got engineers. So I get to have a lot of fun doing my work. So it's really cool. So give a few, thanks for ringing the bell there. It's going to be a holding quiz here to see who recognizes the interest. Actually, I have a talk coming up in a couple of days. I think my talk on Friday, I'm going to try to get as many holding pictures in as I can. So,
I could probably sneak a couple of pictures.
Exactly.
It's Bonanza, yeah. I could probably sneak a couple of pictures in of you and your crew up there tearing the diversion down.
Yeah.
2003, was it?
Yeah.
2002.
Yeah, I was having dinner with Andy. Yeah, exactly. My wife and Sam's. Richardson and his sons were there. One of their primary disappointments is they haven't had enough finance.
Yeah. They hiked Cloud Pass yesterday and back.
They did. Yeah. That was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
That's
a long time.
If I knew you were going to arrive, I would have slipped one in here somewhere. Chicken pictures around. Although we have three at home, so I probably could have found it. Yeah.
Well, that's almost pets more than egg supply.
They are. Eggs are bonus.
You just got to be more careful about what you bring up.
Well, I got a memo today. I wouldn't be asked to do devotions.
I did some really bad ones without. Now
when
we're eating chicken for
seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that was a really quick response to get that chicken out of the freezer.
Talking about chickens with their heads cut off, I remember when the son of the folks of the ranch that I worked on was bluing some weapons, re-bluing them, and he left his chemicals out on the yard, and chickens got into it. It was death on the chicken.
Yeah. Jeez. Chicken processing. Chicken processing. Well, I'm going to get started because it's a few minutes after and it is holding time, so I understand we'll have a few more stragglers in here. But my name is Jamie Schick. I'm an engineering geologist from Portland, Oregon, and I'm very excited to be here to do some presentations on various topics, all of my choosing. And I got asked to do this, and I was like, well, okay, sure. What do you want me to talk about? And he was like, well, anything you want to. So I made my life more difficult. Instead of just talking about things I know about, I sort of chose topics I didn't know so much about because I thought it would be interesting to know more about something I like. So So there's probably a good chance you'll stump me at some point with a question or two, but that's okay. I have four topics that I'm going to cover this week. First one is just sort of a discussion about geology. Where did it come from? A little bit of history. What does it mean to everybody? You know, geology is sort of a common term. My other talks, Wednesday, I'll talk a little bit about geologic hazards, their impact on humanity, a little bit about how we as humanity try to sort of avoid the impacts, sometimes more successfully than others. A little whirlwind tour, you know, this is like a multiple semester course that you can spend talking about geology of the Pacific Northwest. So I'm going to kind of splash on a few interesting topics, and then Friday try to zoom back into the North Cascades and talk a little bit about the North Cascades and also Holden in particular, both geology-wise and also a little bit about some of the amazing sort of glacially created features that we have here in the valley. So, so for starters, you know, when I think of geology, and I'm going to give my opinion and I want to ask everybody else, you know, I think about rocks, obviously. I think about hazards like volcanoes at St. Helens erupting. I think about processes like taking a sand dune and turning it into a sandstone. Those are all sorts of things that I think about what geologists do and what they were trying to study the earth and earth processes to sort of understand where we are today and what we see in our landscape. So anybody else have a thought or an opinion on what geology means to them?
Very basic. It's the story of the earth.
Mm-hmm. Structure of the earth. The surfaces, the right. Internal as well.
What we see.
Yeah. What we don't see and what we do see.
What are our questions about what's underground?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I, of course, being a slave to a computer, turned to Wikipedia to get an idea, and there's way, and I'm not, this is like more, this is as many words as I'm going to use for the rest of the presentation, so I'm not, don't worry. But there,
no, we are responsible to know these.
But there's a quiz, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So, and you know, it's the blue do actually a nice job, history of life, plate tectonics, history of the earth, minerals and hydrocarbons are a huge factor in geology and advancements in geology because it's through resource extraction that a lot of research was funded. So there's a very close connection to resource extraction. Water resources is a huge issue that I'll talk about more about on Wednesday, as well as natural hazards. So those are all sort of parts of that.
Why is water, I understand, you know, processes and stuff, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a whole other study of
hydrology. Well, hydrology is more is when I think of hydrology is more surface hydraulics. So surface waters and the study of surface water processes, whereas hydrogeology is the understanding of groundwater, which overlaps. Honestly, you can't really just, you know, not consider one without the other. But it's an important subset of geologic studies. You know, finding water, how do we get it out of the ground? How do we clean it up? A lot of hydrogeologists are paid now to clean up water because we've spilled things into it. So.
Well, then I want to know about fracking, whether I should be worried or not.
Yeah, you know, we could talk a long time about fracking. So it depends on who you want, whose opinion you want. So,
okay.
There's a lot of...
For sale.
Yeah, well, yes, I think so. This is just a picture of the San Andreas Fault, which I thought was kind of interesting. You can see the very distinct linear feature there running through with ponds and sags in the middle of it. Webster's was a little more simple. You know, the study deals with the history of the earth. The thing I liked about Webster's that I like about a lot of dictionaries is the second meaning is the geologic features of an area. So it doesn't really tell you much about what geology means. Engineering geology is really sort of, in my field, taking geologic observations and communicating that to the engineering community so that they don't do something that would potentially result in a highway being destroyed. This is in Taiwan, and the entire hillside just let loose and covered the highway up. So we try to avoid that as an engineering geologist.
Yeah, it's not a success.
It's a bad, bad, bad reputation to have that happen. I was in Bellingham giving a lecture up at Western Washington for their geology department, and went out for beverages afterwards with their professors. And one of them was grumbling about how their students were like, oh, this is like math class. They were so disappointed. They thought geology was just outside, enjoying nature, and looking at things. And there's a tremendous amount of mathematics that goes into geology once you sort of dig a little bit deeper. And so we were talking about the relationship of science and math. And so his analogy, which I thought was really nice, was that at the very core is math. And the first layer outside of that is physics. Physics is very integrated with mathematics and sort of applying mathematics to physics. And then the next layer of the onion was chemistry, because chemistry deals a lot with physics and math, but also molecules and sort of reactions and chemical processes. And then the next layer was biology, because you're doing physics and you're integrating chemistry, but you're also looking at life processes. And then the last layer was geology, because we got to think about all of this, because we think about life and life processes, and we look at past environments by looking at the fossils in the rock and saying, well, this was a tropical environment, or this was the desert, or whatnot. So we basically encompass everything. As geologists, we encompass everything inside the onion shell. So I thought that was an elegant presentation of what geology is. So I'm going to talk a little bit about, much of the rest of this talk is going to sort of take geology and the study of the Earth from Greek and Roman times up through plate tectonics. And I apologize, there's not as many pictures in this presentation as there will be in some other ones, but I think there's some interesting topics in here that hopefully generate a little bit of discussion. Greeks were some of the earliest to sort of start to try to understand Earth processes. And I put up there Aristotle, of course. It seems like every time you go back in time and look at something that goes back to the Greeks, his name shows up. But actually, it was one of his students that really sort of took the study of geology kind of to the next level, and they wrote on stones, and I'm going to butcher his name, but Theophratus, I believe, is how they pronounced it. The Greeks were very interested in their jewelry and gems, and so they, of course, started looking at, well, where am I going to find stones, or where am I going to find gems or metals that I could extract. So they had some fairly amazing mines that people would crawl into, and most of it was gold or silver, that there was actual native silver they could see if they didn't have the ability to extract disseminated or fine-grained gold, so it was readily available. They also did a lot of work in metallurgy, how to get metals out of rock. And he was one of the first to really sort of sit down and try to be a little more systematic in how you characterize minerals, their hardness, their color, how they react to heat, all these sorts of basic sort of understandings. That was about 300 years later. The Romans continued sort of exploring the Earth and sort of understanding where we're going to, again, very much a mineral-driven process, but also starting to get an idea of, like, maybe the Earth is, the processes that we see take a long time to occur. So this whole sense of, like, time being beyond maybe where we were, where we're thinking in our daily lives. There was about a 1,000-year period when there wasn't a tremendous amount of exploration in the geosciences. Even in the mining industries, there was not a lot of mineral extraction that was going on, in part because there was a period of time where people were spending a lot more time just sort of surviving. You know, we had a lot of challenges, and so a lot of the development in the geology industry wasn't actually happening in Europe. It was over in the Far East. Muslims in Indonesia, the Chinese, were all sort of looking at different processes, understanding, you know, some of these were in very seismically active areas, so they're trying to understand, well, where do earthquakes come from? And, you know, in some areas they actually saw where there was, you know, ground rupture, and so how does that happen? We, you know, we're exploring, we're in the mountains, we see fossils up high in the mountains. How do we get the fossils up there? So they were asking some of these basic questions of, you know, I see a fossil of a fish, but we're a mile above the ground. How does that happen? So, you know, basic questions, but really important ones. It wasn't until the 1600s in Europe that we started seeing a little bit more inquisition into where the earth came from. And a lot of that was associated with looking a little bit deeper into the Bible's interpretation of the earth being 6,000 years old. And this continues today, obviously. A lot of people have heard of different theories that are out there. But this is was a fundamental question even then, and we knew a lot less than we did then. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. William Whishton was one of the first to come up with a sort of a theory of catastrophism, which basically says that Earth was created not through a series of small events that changed over time, but major large events that basically rapidly changed the Earth's surface, such as the Great Flood. So it was an attempt to sort of explain how you could have a biblical interpretation of the creation of the Earth based on what we see on the Earth's surface. Another sort of early explorer in the geosciences was actually a Catholic bishop, and you know, one of the things that I really liked about this particular subject was just all the different really smart people that you run into that have thought about these things. The principles that he came up with are actually fairly basic, but no one had actually sort of put it together. So you know, original horizontality, lateral continuity, cross-cutting relationships were all basically formulated through a lot of his work. And he traveled extensively all over Europe looking at various deposits and you know, trying to understand where things were coming from. Some examples, laws of superposition is basically just saying, you know, the oldest layer's at the bottom, and as you stack things on top, you get younger. You know, I mean, it's usually what our bill pile looks like. You know, the oldest bill's at the bottom, so that's why you flip them over when you pay your bills. Well, you know, a cake is the same way, and so aren't layers of soil or rock. When you go out to a location, you usually assume that the dirt that's on the bottom is older than the dirt that's on the top. Same with rocks. And that usually holds true. It does get more complicated, but that's typically a fairly basic assumption. Another one was looking at what's called cross-cutting relationships. These are sort of geogeek diagrams. The one here on the left, you know, youngest on top, oldest on the bottom, and then you say, well, that came first, and then if you have a dike that goes through, that probably happened sometime after. And it can get progressively more complicated, but the basic idea was that you could sort of unfold the history of what you were looking at by looking at these relationships of what cuts across something else.
What's a dike?
A dike is basically a volcanic rock, typically, or some sort of magmatic rock, liquid rock, that intrudes into the surrounding rock. So, like say you have basalt that's down in the earth, and it moves up towards the earth's surface, it's got to sort of push its way through there. So what's left behind is the rock that's around it, and then the rock that sort of pushed up through it. So you know that the rock that was around it was there prior to that intrusion. And thanks for actually mentioning that. Anybody who doesn't understand a term that I throw out, just let me know. So I easily forget these things. So another, I think, fairly interesting early geologist was Abraham Werner. He's actually from Germany. And he was actually one of the more famous lecturers of the time. People traveled from all over Europe to go listen to this guy because he was such a dynamic speaker. He was a mining geologist, one of the early mining geologists, so a lot of people paid him to help them sort of find mining resources. He did a lot of work in sort of mineral characterization, sort of coming up with hardness for different types of minerals. One of his maybe not so successful theories was during the 1700s there was competing theories about how the Earth was formed. One Neptunism and one Plutonism. And he was a favor of Neptunism, which basically was that all the rocks that we see came from deposition in the oceans. And that essentially volcanoes were a recent phenomenon, and even basalts were basically precipitates or recrystallizations of sedimentary rock. So that didn't last very long, but it was an interesting theory, and I think a lot of, as you're trying to sort something out, you go down a variety of different paths. So it's an example of a different path that we took as geologists trying to understand the Earth's history. Maps are a huge part of geology, and interpreting maps and creating maps. The earliest maps were created of England, and it was actually created by a surveyor. And this is a fellow, William Smith. He actually worked in the mines over in Wales and was finding all these fossils. And then he started doing survey work for the canals that cut across England. And he'd find these fossils on the other side of England in the same types of rock and started to put this picture together that maybe these are all related. And so he basically used some of the principles that had already been developed to sort of say, well, you know, let's try to trace these out. And he had the survey skills, so he was able to actually create a map of the different layers of geology. Unfortunately, he was just a surveyor, which means that in those days he came from fairly common background, and a lot of his work was actually plagiarized, and he actually spent years in debtor jail because no one would believe that it was his work. Fortunately, in the end, that was rectified, but it was an unfortunate twist. So James Hutton was one of the first what we could consider modern geologists, and a lot of his writings were really sort of getting into this issue of the evidence that we saw was that rocks took a long time to make, and that we see lots of sediments being deposited, and we see weak rock and stronger rock. We see fossils that we don't see here anymore. The process of uplifting mountains was clearly not something that happened overnight. He created this term, no vestige or beginning, no prospect of end. And unfortunately, that's not very conclusive. So it opens you up to a lot of questions. Well, if you can't define something, how do you know what's really going on? So there were a lot of issues around that. About the same time, a new sort of theory about the processes of geology or of the Earth started coming out, and we call this uniformitarianism. And this is still a fairly common assumption today. One of the first pictures I showed was of the sand dunes and then the sandstone. And so a lot of what we look at today as geologists, we say, well, we see this process going on today, and we see what it creates. And so we try to interpret that on the history. So, for instance, we see a volcanic lava flow, and we say, well, this has the features, this has the characteristics of a lava flow. It has a certain type of texture, so we look at lava flows in Hawaii, and we say, well, this texture looks just like this, so this is probably how it got there. So it's a very standard way of trying to sort of interpret activities of the past. And this was sort of, again, one of the sort of founding principles that were developed in the 1800s. Again, the same concept. You know, if you were to dig into this sand dune, you'd see essentially what you see on the right. All these piles. If you've gone out to the desert or out to the beach and you look at a big sand dune, basically the sand is blowing up and over and then falls down the other side. And you can sort of see over here where you've got these four slopes where the sand is going up a ramp, and then, but then at the same time it's being cut off on this other side is another layer of sand kind of comes across the top of that. So, and just what we're trying to do with uniformitarianism is use the present as the key to the past.
Could I ask?
Yeah.
It seems like all of these are English names. Was the science really developing in England primarily?
You know, England was a, it wasn't all English work, but it certainly was a focal point of geologic studies. You know, we had the one fellow from Abraham Werner that was from Germany, but I think a lot of theories about geology were coming out in England. I think a lot of work was being done outside of that in sort of mapping geology and exploring geology. So obviously we have a good understanding of geologic processes in Europe and in other places. But England was a sort of a focal point of a lot of these studies. The Royal Geological Society was centuries old. So there was a lot of work going on in England at the time. I think that there may be a little bit more well published as well in that respect.
And meanwhile, you had mentioned, you know, around 1000 AD, India and China, what was happening
over there as well. You know, I didn't explore that as far. So most of my documents, most of the geological manuals that you go to and books on geology are focused on sort of European advancements in the geosciences. But clearly we were trying to, you know, in those areas we were looking for mineral resources and trying to understand earth processes. But most of the work that I saw was that's coming out, and most of the resources were more sort of European based. So you know, as far as the year, as far as Asia goes, I'm sure there was more exploration, but I think that was more, it wasn't as advanced and wasn't as published as well as some of the areas that I was looking at. So, Lord Kelvin, who was also named William Thompson, was probably one of the premier physicists, mathematicians of the 1800s. Absolute zero is based on Kelvin's. Produced the first and second law of thermodynamics. This was obviously a super bright guy. He also used math to try to create, to try to calculate how old the Earth was. Basically saying, well, if we started from some temperature and we looked at the rate of cooling, how old could the Earth be? If the Earth was a solid and a closed system. And he had a series of assumptions that he used, and you know, this was all through through mathematically reliable sources, and came up with an age of the Earth between 80, I think it was, what, 20 and 100 million years old. And you know, this was in part a response to the open-endedness of geologists saying, well, the Earth's really old, but we don't really know how old. So he wasn't necessarily arguing against the geologists, he was just trying to quantify it. And of course, the response from the geological community was, well, we think it's much older than this, we just can't prove it. And that's not very satisfying either. So, you know, there's actually a lot that we owe Kelvin from the standpoint of geology, because a lot of the work in the 1800s was focused on trying to prove that the Earth was a different age. So, what actually was the driving force in sort of, from a scientific standpoint, saying that the Earth must be much older was actually the discovery of radiation in the early turn of the 20th century. Part of his assumption was that the Earth was a closed system, that there was no other heat source except for the initial temperature of the Earth. And so as soon as it was obvious that there's a lot of radioactive material, and part of what the energy is also another, most of the energy is in the form of heat. That's why we have nuclear reactors. So all of a sudden, we have this huge new heat source. And so you can use a lot of this to say, well, the Earth must be much older because it's generating heat all on its own. It turns out, interestingly enough, that this actually isn't why the Earth, this doesn't actually prove from a thermodynamics standpoint how heat can be used to calculate the age of the Earth, because electrical radiation doesn't actually produce that much heat. So it was used to refute Kelvin's age, but it's actually not the right answer. So unfortunately for everybody, but it was actually used for radioactive age dating, and that actually proved to be a much more powerful tool for geologists to establish, or at least to make estimates for the age of individual rocks. And the basic premise is that you have, in this case it's showing uranium, but you have a rock that has some sort of radioactive material, and those atoms decay over time, and they decay to different daughter products. In this case, it's uranium. It's a very common age dating combination, uranium to lead as a parent daughter product. So, if you can measure how much lead is in the rock that you have in hand, you can sort of backtrack the age of the rock that you were, you know, when it was formed. So, a lot of times, what you do is you go in and you get a rock. You try to pull out, like in granite, you're looking for a certain kind of mineral called a zircon. And like, it's not like the zirconium, fake diamonds, but it actually traps uranium, but it excludes lead at initial state. So when it was formed, it probably was formed with no lead in it. So any of the lead that you find that's in the mineral now had to have come from the uranium that was in there at the same time. So that has turned out to be a very useful tool for aging, age dating. Not just rock, but actually, I think most people have heard of carbon-14 dating. That's a very standard way of getting an idea of how old a sample of carbon is, organic material. During the 1800s, I've sort of focused the first part of this talk, and it's been a little bit dry in my book, but it was kind of interesting to research. A lot about sort of some of the basic principles that were being developed during the 1800s and earlier than that. You know, a lot of the driving force to sort of mapping the country was came from the state and the federal governments funding geologists running around and trying to figure out what was at the surface of the earth. A lot of that was driven by resource extraction, you know, either mining or petroleum work. Was a major funding of this. USGS was formed, you know, 130 some odd years ago now. We produced lots of maps, some of them more complicated than others. This is a taste of what we'll be looking at a little bit more on Friday. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail. Just know that someone actually had to go out and look at all this and figure out where all those little lines go in this kind of terrain. And the North Cascades was actually one of the last places to get mapped, just because it was terrain like we see all around here, and trying to get from point A to point B was no small task. So
are those rocks?
Those are all, yeah, thank you for asking a good question. These are all rocks. The arrow is to Holden. The Glacier Peak is here in the corner, just to give you sort of a scale. There's Lake Chelan. This is both what's called a bedrock map, as well as surface soil deposits. So most of this country has got rock exposed to the ground surface. In a few areas, we've got some sort of surficial material. The arrow ends at something that looks a little bit like the tailings piles. But there's also a bunch of fluvial deposits in the drainage there that leads down to Lucerne at the far left there. So this is a map, you know, and we like to use all our crazy colors to create maps. So this map is basically, for me, it's communicating if I were to go to any one spot, that's the kind of rock I would expect to see. And this usually comes with a big key that has lots of little details and descriptions of all the different types of rocks. So I can spend hours looking at those. This last past century, a lot of the focus was shifting from the Earth as a fixed surface to ultimately plate tectonics that we talk about today. And the discussion started at the turn of the century, where we had, and they called it fixists and mobilists at that point, which I thought was actually a fairly accurate description. And, you know, I think a lot of people have looked at Africa and South Africa, South America and said, well, gosh, that kind of fits, sort of. And, you know, these series of slides are sort of saying this is an interpretation of how those continents separated over time. You know, if you look at the geology of South America and Africa, you actually find a lot of the same fossils, a lot of the same rocks, a lot of the general geology prior to about 135 million years ago is very similar. So it's, you know, those were some of the pieces of the pie that they were looking at initially with the concept of continental drift. Evidence that I'm going to sort of throw at you. If anything I say doesn't make any sense, let me know. This is getting a little more techie, but paleomagnetism, magnetic striping, and seismicity were all sort of key components that we were looking at and trying to piece together. We were getting all this evidence and saying, well, how does this fit? Paleomagnetism, where everybody uses a compass. Well, maybe people use their smartphone, unless you're holding it. And basically we use the fact that there's this magnetic field around the Earth, and we've assumed north to be the way that the magnet points, and certain rocks have high contents of iron in them, and so when, in particular lava rocks, when they're cooling, those iron crystals will orient towards the North Pole. So there's a whole field of crazy geologists, and all they do all day is they core little holes into the rock and try to keep that core exactly oriented just the way it's supposed to be, and they run to a lab and then they figure out which way north is based on that. And what they start finding out is that sometimes the rock from one location and the rock right next to it or just below it, the orientations were opposite. So it's like, well, was north just kind of shifting around over time, or did it actually flip-flop? And what we found is that the Earth's magnetic field actually does flip-flop. It actually will, north becomes south and south becomes north. And that's captured in the rock record. So, and you actually can see, you go to areas where you have long history of magmatic rock deposition, and you'll find rocks, and we call it reverse magnetized rocks, basically, just because right now north is up. If we'd been there a million years ago, north might have been down, and we'd all think the opposite, but that's where we are now. It's all what we see today must obviously be right. But during the Second World War, we were using magmatics or magnetism to look for submarines. So we were cruising all over the ocean looking for submarines, and every once in a while our magnets and our communication systems or our direction systems would get these weird signals. And you know, we were mostly focused on looking for really strong signals as in a submarine. But some of the scientists started looking at this data and saying, well, maybe we should be a little more systematic about this. So they literally went out and they just drove a boat back and forth across the ocean, mapping the magnetic signal of the ocean's floor. And what they found was this pattern, basically starting at what we call Middle Eastern ridges now, but kind of the center of the ocean. And it followed this pattern where you'd have, you know, normal, reverse, and if you looked on both sides, they're kind of sort of the same thickness. And it's not perfect because you're looking at lava rock spilling onto the ground and it would spill to all different directions. But it was another piece of evidence that was saying, well, maybe, you know, maybe things are moving and maybe there's a pattern to this. Maybe it's a little bit more systematic than we thought. And we were also at that time, we started and this actually started in, the 50s, basically, which someone maybe will correct me on the date, but essentially they set up this this global network of seismographs basically to monitor for above ground nuclear explosions. So it was basically in support of making sure nobody cheated about above ground nuclear testing. So, but as a consequence, we started mapping all these earthquakes. And when you started plotting them up, it was like, wow, that's kind of an interesting pattern. There seems to be like distinct locations where we have earthquakes and then a lot of areas where we don't.
At the same time, the United States Navy was mapping the ocean floor with sonar.
Right. And so we were getting a much better surface of the ocean floor at the same time, which we were finding on these ocean edges. Another piece of evidence was looking at areas like off the coast of South America and Japan, and mapping these earthquakes in 3D, or in this case 2D, down into the surface. And we had this very interesting pattern of earthquakes in sort of linear to depth, almost as if something were being pulled or driven or pushed down underneath another crust. So in the mid-60s, all this evidence coalesced, and they literally had a series of major conferences, and everybody started pulling this data together. And this isn't actually what they produced. But this is a sort of an overview of where they were. And the basic idea is that, and I think a lot of people have probably heard this before, but the concept is that the Earth's crust is pretty thin, and it's shifting and it's moving. And in some areas, the Earth is actually going the crust is going underneath another crust, and this would be what we call a subduction zone. And eventually, this gets deep enough, and it starts to melt. And so we get volcanoes like the Cascades forming in these areas. This could maybe be off the coast, well, actually probably over here, because this is still ocean over here. But you know, say this is Portland, perhaps, and that's Mount Hood. And so we have a subducting slab that's going underneath it. And of course, you've got a lot of friction that happens, and the plates get stuck, and then they move, and we get a big earthquake, which is a major issue in the Pacific Northwest. We're all wondering when the next big one is going to be. Likewise, we had places where the crust is coming apart, and these were these mid-ocean ridges where things are spreading. We've got volcanic material coming up and erupting on the ocean floor. So these are all sort of coming together. We have hot spots, and I'll talk about this a little bit more in a few days, where we get volcanoes like Hawaii out in the middle of nowhere, and you see these chains, and actually would have been a nice chain, but if you look at Hawaii and all the islands, they form a nice linear pattern, and then they turn. And that actually turns out to be when the plates change directions. So, all these sort of pieces that were finally coming together, and people were starting putting all these pieces to come up with this model in a slightly bigger sense. They also figured out that we had convection going on sort of in the mantle. And this is actually the real reason why Kelvin's theory didn't work. So we get a lot of heat being brought up through these convection cells, which are drivers to a lot of the plate tectonics that we see. And that's actually what's going on as far as what sort of blows his theory up. It wasn't radiation, but actually the sort of the bigger picture. And this was actually thrown out there as a hypothesis back in the late 1800s, but we just weren't ready for that concept at that time. So anyway, that's a quick flash of geology history. There are lots of different topics and questions that could be asked. This is actually, I'm throwing last slides up to kind of get people to come back, hopefully. So I'll talk a little bit more about this on Wednesday. This is actually out in Idaho, and it's a huge rockfall site. We were actually called out by the Idaho Department of Transportation, and they had a couple 100,000 cubic yards of rock come from way up here and came down and covered the road up. and we got to go out there and figure out what's going on. So, but you have to get back tomorrow or Wednesday to find out about that. So,
what's the river there?
That's actually the Snake River.
It is. I wondered.
Yeah, yeah. This is actually an amazing little stretch of highway because the rocks are all dipping towards. So this would be on the east side of the river. All the rocks are dipping towards the river, and it's fairly slick rock. And so the rock has a tendency to slide on these planes that are all sort of trending towards the river. So this side of the river is all just huge landslides that keep damming up the river and pushing it in different directions. And then the other side, we have these big cliffs, which provide work for people like me to go and figure out what to do about it. So anyway, questions, thoughts, perspectives? One of the topics that I didn't get into a whole lot was the whole issue of, you know, the interpretation of the age of the earth from a religious standpoint. If other people have thoughts or opinions on that, I'd certainly be a good point of discussion.
I don't think we have any Scientologists here, but we might.
Well, I had a couple of people that asked me questions today, and I said, wow, boy, I don't know if anybody's going to have a strong opinion about it or not. So.
What is the scientific best estimate now?
The age of the Earth?
Mm-hmm.
The oldest rocks, well, there's two different age dates, actually. Since you ask a geologist question, we'll give you two answers. The oldest rocks we've been able to come up with are approximately 4.5 billion years old. It's from the Archean, and they're actually some of these zircons. So it's a sandstone, which is basically a rock that's formed by erosion of another rock. So it's these little zircon crystals in sandstone. So we just know that the zircon must have formed sometime before the sandstone in order to get there. And those are about 4.5 billion years old. We also use meteorites because they're chunks of supposedly, you know, sort of early material that was formed at the early part of the solar system. So we've done age dating on meteorites, and that also turns out to be about 4.5 billion years old. So that's our best guess at this point, as far as the age there is.
You were commenting about finding things at unusual places in terms of their age. And in the field science of fisheries, we have determined that our salmon here in the Pacific Northwest are at least 1 million years old because we found fossils in the Columbia River drainage near Colville that were carbon dated at 1 million years of age.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Columbia River has a very interesting history because it's been pushed around for millions of years.
Yeah.
You know, Columbia River basalts have repeatedly filled up the channels and the reservoirs and the ravines carved by the Columbia River. Even in Portland, you can go to areas in Portland where you can see where the old Columbia River used to be, and it's now 500 feet of Columbia River basalts. So it's had a torturous path.
At one point you mentioned when you had an early slide up with the Egyptians, and they were basically going after gold and silver, and there's very few things that occur in their natural state. Most are, you have to, I guess,
do some sort of processing through it. Yeah.
At what point did that start occurring?
Well, you know, really, the Iron Age was when that sort of first occurred, where we figured out by heating certain iron-rich rocks to a certain temperature, we could get the iron to actually melt and separate out. So, you know, metallurgy goes back even further, basically, to our basic, tool and weapon making endeavors. So, and I suspect that through some of that, we started, as we heated certain rocks up, we got things we didn't expect, gold probably being one of them. And then, you know, we found that gold was a fairly malleable material that we could actually create visually appealing to some, art and jewelry and that sort of thing. So it's a pretty old technology in that respect. So I didn't have as many slides up. One of the things I was looking into is some of this old mining technology. The average life expectancy for a miner back in the Greek age was about 3 months. So that was, you know, it was basically slave labor. They just, and unfortunately, it was mostly children because they used, they made really small holes. You know, they were just following like a vein of gold that was sort of winding its way through the earth. So the only people big enough to get into these things were small people. And so they just sent them there, you know, to conquer another nation. Well, that was, you'd be sent off to the mines. Yeah.
From a layman's perspective on God creating the earth and God creating people, I say, I'm pretty sure God did it, and we're just finding out what processes he used in creating the earth and creating. That's the only way I can reconcile science and faith.
No, I completely, from my personal perspective, I don't believe the earth is 6,000 years old, but I don't see any conflict there for that exact reason. You know, saying that God created the earth, I'm not saying that God created the earth either. I wouldn't necessarily say in 6 days. I wasn't around at the Big Bang, but you know, just the whole processes and time is you know, we've got all the time in the world to see things happen. So yeah, I don't think there is a conflict necessarily.
Do you talk about God's continuous creation?
I do not tonight, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, and it's a you know, erosion of is maybe a, you know, from a continuum standpoint, you could look at erosion processes of, you know, taking a mountain and turning it into you know, bay mud, and then it becomes a mountain again, and then it's eroded. And so there's, you know, there's a continuum there that you know, just like life at Holden, you know, I've been coming here for 16 years, and it's remarkable how much you see things repeat itself, and you know, things change, and then you come back 10 years later, and it's kind of like it was 10 years ago, and you know, it's just this never-ending sort of rejuvenation and return.
Thank you.